From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Robert Siegel. 30 years ago today, Jimi Hendrix died of a drug overdose in London. He was 27 years old. Hendrix's music and onstage antics, loud, turbulent, and sexual, came to symbolize the 1960s. But Hendrix was also a gifted musician and one of the most innovative and influential electric guitarists in history. As part of the NPR 100, our look at the most influential American music of the past century, Jesse Wegman looks back at the song that was Jimi Hendrix's signature, Purple Haze.
Jimi Hendrix once said, "When I die, I want people to just play my music, go wild and freak out, and do anything they want to do." Okay, so how about Purple Haze for string quartet? Or flute? Prefer bluegrass? Or even classical guitar? But if you want to hear Purple Haze on the instrument it was written for, there's really only one place to go. For more than three decades, this music has inspired and humbled guitar players everywhere. Mike Bloomfield, one of the top blues rock guitarists of the 1960s, said the first time he saw Hendrix play, he didn't want to pick up his guitar for a year. Vernon Reid is a guitarist and record producer who played with the rock band Living Color.
I think a lot of people take up the challenge with Jimmy in terms of trying to sound like him or trying to play like him, which is like really daunting. I think the challenge with Jimmy is, this is what I've done. Okay, you're up next. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with your life?
As a kid in Seattle, Jimi Hendrix taught himself to play by listening to blues greats Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. He played in high school bands, and later, after a stint in the Army, found work as a backup musician, touring with rock and rhythm and blues artists Little Richard, King Curtis, and the Isley Brothers. But a sideman has to play exactly what he's told. Hendrix quickly lost patience with this. Listen to the Isley Brothers from 1965, with Hendrix playing lead. Remember, it's barely a year before he would write Purple Haze. For Hendrix, this style of playing got old fast, so he quit and moved to New York, where he tried to survive by playing small clubs in Greenwich Village. It was there that he developed the foundations of his style, a loud, fast mix of blues and R&B. But not many people were listening, until one night, when Chaz Chandler stopped by. Chandler had recently left the popular British band The Animals to try his hand at producing. In Jimi Hendrix, he saw his first potential client.
It's all about facilitating Hendrix's talent.
Hendrix biographer John McDermott.
I think what Chandler realized is, with some parameters, this man is a tremendous artist. And I think he was smart enough to recognize that I need to get this rhythm section around him, we need to be in a good studio, and it'll all take care of itself.
Chandler insisted Hendrix return with him to England, where they immediately held auditions for a backing band to be called the Jimi Hendrix Experience. At first, it had nothing to do with experience. Bassist Noel Redding had never actually played the bass before. He was a guitarist. And drummer Mitch Mitchell, whose background was jazz, was chosen by a coin toss. But the three men soon got comfortable, and their first single, a cover of the song Hey Joe, was released that November and quickly became a hit in England.
Hey Joe, where you going with that gun of yours? Hey Joe, I
In 1966, England was the perfect place for Hendrix. The Rolling Stones had already popularized American blues, and young people there were starting to see the possibilities of the electric guitar in the playing of Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck. But even the best guitarists of the day worked for the most part within a standard blues structure. Hendrix wanted to do something completely different. John McDermott says Chaz Chandler spent hours listening to Hendrix experiment with riffs.
Jimmy was playing a small club date in London and was backstage toying with the riff of Purple Haze. And Chaz, being there, heard it immediately and said, write the rest of that. That's the next single. Because I think he had heard enough of Jimmy, even in the 2 or 3 months that they were together, to know that that is something very special. Work on that.
Hendrix did. Soon, he had 10 pages of lyrics. In a late 1960s interview, Hendrix remembered an early draft of the song.
Oh, cool, you should hear the real Purple Haze. It has about 10 verses, but it goes into different changes. You know, it isn't just Purple Haze, all in, you know, blah, 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 blah.
He explained later that the idea for the words to Purple Haze came to him in a dream after he'd read a science fiction novel. Fans and critics have spent years trying to decipher the song's meaning. Hendrix himself pointed to the one line at the end of the second verse. With Chandler's help, Hendrix edited the song down to 3 minutes, and the experience cut a demo. Then, with money from the sales of Hey Joe, Chandler moved the band to Olympic, a new studio across town, where they were matched up with an adventurous young engineer named Eddie Kramer.
The studio manager said to me one day, you know, Eddie, there's this American chappie with the big hair called Jimi Hendrix. You do all that weird stuff, so why don't you do this? You know, it's very English, very proper, and we hit it off. I mean, there was just a good feeling. He was very shy. But when he stepped out on the studio floor and, you know, plugged in, oh, my God, it was a revelation for me. You know, I'd never heard anything quite like it.
Hendrix immediately liked Kramer and his willingness to experiment. And both quickly learned Chandler's one rule in the studio. There were no rules. For example, who says you're always supposed to record at normal speed? There's a high-pitched guitar at the end of Purple Haze that sounds almost like a mandolin. Kramer explains that to get it, he set the tape recorder to half speed.
And Jimmy recorded dot 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 dot, and of course when you play it back, it's dot 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 dot, it's double the speed. So if you played a fairly rapid figure at half speed, it would be really silly fast at high speed, and that's what it was.
Hendrix had such a deep understanding of the guitar that he knew his own solos backwards and forwards. And since he didn't have a day of formal musical training to his credit, Hendrix came up with his own method of teaching his songs to his bandmates.
A sort of large legal pad with copious notes of, first of all, you know, the lyric content possibly, and then he would describe in detail where certain things would be happening in the song. Okay, drum hit here, bass drum pattern here, and it would be a map of the song.
And even though the technology was primitive, Hendrix experimented endlessly with sound, working with effects boxes that were built especially for him. During his live shows, he turned up his amplifiers and got sounds out of his guitar that no one had ever heard before. Here's the end of his performance of Purple Haze from Woodstock. One more thing. Hendrix was left-handed, so he restrung his guitar and turned it upside down. But as comfortable as Hendrix was with a guitar in his hands, Eddie Kramer remembers that he dreaded stepping in front of a microphone.
He hated the way he sounded. He thought he had the worst voice in the world. He was embarrassed about his vocal performance. So much so that I had to build a series of screens, three sides, facing away from the control window so nobody could see what he was doing. We had to turn all the lights off in the studio except for a little light where he had his lyrics. And he would do the take and we would stop and he would poke his head around the side of the screens and say, hey, how was that? Was it all right? Are you sure it's okay? And I'd say, Jimmy, it was great, it was great. Yeah, come on, let's go, keep doing. Oh, all right, okay, well, we'll do one more then.
In March 1967, Purple Haze, the single, was released in England and shot up the charts. 3 months later, The Experience gave its first U.S. performance at the Monterey Pop Festival. It was at this show that Hendrix doused his guitar with lighter fluid and set it on fire. The moment was captured on film, and Jimi Hendrix became a star in America. Not everyone was impressed. Hendrix's onstage behavior, which in addition to pyrotechnics included unmistakably sexual gestures involving his guitar, led one well-known rock critic to dub him a psychedelic Uncle Tom. In this interview from a 1973 documentary, Hendrix explained he had no time for that kind of criticism.
I don't care, man. I don't care anymore what they say anymore.
Yeah.
It's up to them then if they want to mess up the evening by looking at one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because all that is included, man. When I feel like playing with my teeth, I do it because I feel like it, you know. All that is complete. When I'm on stage, I'm complete natural, more so than, you know, talking to a group of people or something.
While Hendrix rarely expressed himself in racial terms, Vernon Reed says he totally changed the parameters of what black art could be.
He was unabashedly sexual. He didn't apologize to black people for being wild, and he didn't apologize. He didn't, certainly didn't ask for permission from white people. He laid down a gauntlet. You know, he said, "Are you prepared to be free?"
Eddie Kramer remembers feeling something similar as he watched Hendrix in the studio.
The brain to the heart to the hands to the feet. It was one fluid motion. There was never any question, never any doubt as to where he would put his hands on the guitar, what sound would come out. And I don't think there is any musician that I've worked with in the last 30-odd years that has ever come close to that.
Nor have there been many musicians who accomplished so much in such a short time. John McDermott.
You know, here was a guy who, in 4 years, changed the face of rock and roll, reinterpreted the role of the electric guitar in that music, and in 4 years, you know? So I think that had he been able to have a lengthy career, it's impossible to think about, you know, what he would have done. I mean, you know, people live their lives to figure that out.
In August 1970, a month before his death, Hendrix told an interviewer, "I'm back where I started. I've given this music everything, but I still sound the same." He went on to say, "Something new has to come, and Jimi Hendrix will be there." You might say he never left. For NPR News, I'm Jesse Wegman.